Hello. Before we begin, a quick note. The Boy to Sleep podcast relies on you and sponsors, which means you will hear a quick advertisement before the beginning of tonight's episode. While the podcast is free, you are welcome to subscribe for just $2.99 per month, which supports the creation of this podcast and gives you an ad-free listening experience. Simply click the link in the show notes from your podcast app. Rest easy.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello. Welcome to the Bore You to Sleep podcast. The podcast that will hopefully help you get to sleep. I am going to read an open source book, one that is not particularly interesting, but one that is hopefully boring enough to get you to sleep. Tonight's reading comes from How Animals Talk and Other Pleasant Studies of Birds and Beast, published in 1919 and written by William J. Long. This story explores the different ways in which animals talk to each other and us. My name is Teddy, and I aim to help people everywhere get a good night's rest. Sleep is so important, and my mission is to help you get the rest that you need. The podcast is designed to play in the background while you slowly fall asleep. For those of you who may not know, this podcast was originally created because I had my own issues with sleep. I wanted to bring another resource to people out there who may have similar issues to my own. The podcast is self-made and produced, which is why you'll hear a quick ad at the beginning of each episode. With the help of subscribers and Patreon sponsors, I am able to achieve my goal of keeping this podcast free for those who need it. Thank you to everyone who shared their words of gratitude with me during the week, whether it be through the website or the podcast app. A massive thank you goes to new supporters on Patreon, Sharisha M., Alex N., and Megan R. It's amazing to hear from you, and also to have your support with a $5 monthly contribution. Thank you, of course, to the new subscribers of the podcast, who are now also benefiting from an ad-free experience, while, of course, supporting the show. And thank you also to all existing subscribers and Patreon sponsors. I appreciate each and every one of you, as well as all of the listeners around the world, wherever you are. If you find the podcast beneficial and would like to support the podcast, there are a few ways you can contribute. Be sure, of course, to follow the podcast in your podcast app. Of course, you are welcome to become a subscriber of the podcast for $2.99 per month, which will ensure that you remove any Spotify ads at the beginning of the episode, and you can do that from your podcast app, whichever you're using, simply by clicking in the link. If that is not possible, and I appreciate that it is not possible for everyone, an easy way to support the podcast is, of course, by following and leaving a review and rating in your podcast app. Even one sentence really helps out. You're always welcome to say hello to me at boytosleep.com. I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at boytosleep. In the meantime, lie back, relax, and enjoy the readings. How Animals Talk by William J. Long. How Animals Talk and Other Pleasant Studies of Birds and Beasts. Chapter 1. Did you ever see two friendly dogs meet when one tried to tell the other of something he had discovered? When they touched noses, stood for a moment in strange, silent parley, then wagged their tails with mutual understanding and hurried off together on a canine junket. That was the little comedy which first drew my attention to the matter of animal communication many years ago, and set my feet in the unblazed trail we are now to follow. And a very woodsy trail you shall find it, dim and solitary, with plenty of blind spots where one may easily go astray, and without any promise of what waits at the other end of it. One summer afternoon, I was reading by the open window, while my old setter Don lay at on his side in the shade of syringa bush. He had scooped out a hollow to suit him, and was enjoying the touch of the cool earth when a fat little terrier, a neighbor's pet, came running with evident excitement to wake the old dog up. Don half raised his head, recognized his friend Nip, and thumped the ground lazily with his tail. "It's all right, little dog. You're always excited over something of no consequence. But don't bother me this hot day," he said, and dropped his head to sleep again. But Nip was not to be put aside, having something big on his mind. He nudged Don sharply and the old dog sprang to his feet as if galvanized. For an interval of perhaps 5 seconds, they stood motionless, tense, their noses almost touching. Then Don's plume began to wave. "Oh, I see," he said, and Nip's stubby tail whipped violently, as if to add, "Thank heaven you do, at last." The next moment, they were away on the jump and disappeared round a corner of the house. Here was comedy afoot, so I slipped out through the back door to follow it. The dogs took no notice of me, and probably had no notion that they were observed, for I took pains to keep out of sight till the play was over. Through the hayfield they led me, across the pasture lot, and over a wall at the foot of a half-cultivated hillside. Peering through a chink of the wall, I saw Nip dancing and barking at a rock pile, and between two of the rocks was a woodchuck cornered. For weeks, Nip had been laying siege to that same woodchuck, which had a den on the hillside in a patch of red clover, most convenient to some garden truck. 12 times, to my knowledge, the little dog had rushed the rascal, but as Nip was fat and the chuck cunning, the chase always ended the same way. One comedian diving into the earth with a defiant whistle, leaving the other to scratch or bark impotently outside. Any reasonable dog would soon have tired of such an uneven game, but a terrier is not an unreasonable dog. At first, Nip tried his best to drag Don into the affair, but the old setter had long since passed the heyday of youth, when any kind of adventure could interest him. In the presence of grouse or woodcock, he would still become splendidly animate, and then the years would slip from him as a garment. But to stupid groundhogs and all such small deer, he was loftily indifferent. He was an aristocrat of true blue blood, and I had trained him to let all creatures save his proper game severely alone. So after following Nip once and finding nothing more exciting than a hole in the ground, with the familiar smell of woodchuck about it, he had left the terrier to his own amusement. When speed failed, or wind, it was vastly amusing to watch Nip try to adopt cat strategy, hiding, creeping, scheming to cut off the enemy's retreat. Almost every day he would have another go at the impossible, but he was too fat and too slow, too clumsy, and also too impatient after his doggy kind. By a great effort, he could hold still when his game poked a cautious head out of the burrow for a look all around. But no sooner did the chuck begin to move away from his doorway than the little dog began to fidget in his hiding place, and his tail, the one part of a dog that cannot lie, would wildly betray his emotions. Invariably, he made his rush too soon, and the woodchuck whistled into his den with time to spare. On this summer afternoon, however, Nip had better luck or used better tactics. Whether he went round the hill and came over the top from an unexpected quarter, or lay in wait in his accustomed place with more than his accustomed patience, I have no means of knowing. By some new device or turn of luck, he certainly came between the game and its stronghold, whereupon the chuck scuttled down the hill and took refuge among the rocks. There Nip's courage failed him. He was a little dog with a big bark, and the sight of the grizzled veteran with back against a stone and both flanks protected probably made him realize that it is one thing to chase a chuck which runs away, but quite another thing to enter his cave while he stands facing you, his beady eyes snapping and his big teeth bare. So after a spell of brave barking, Nip had rushed off to fetch a larger dog. All that was natural enough and very dog-like. At least it so appeared to me, after seeing other little dogs play a similar part. But the amazing feature of this particular comedy was that Nip had no difficulty in getting help from a champion, who had refused to be interested up to that critical moment. Through the wall I saw him lead Don straight to the rocks. The old dog thrust in his head, yelped once he was bitten, dragged out the chuck, gave him a shake and a quieting crunch. Then, without the slightest evident concern, he left Nip to worry and finish and brag over the enemy. It is part of the fascination of watching any animal comedy that it always leaves you with a question. And the unanswerable question here was, how did Nip let the other dog know what he wanted? If you are intimate enough with dogs to have discovered that they depend on their noses for all accurate information, that they have, as it were, a smellscape instead of a landscape forever before them, you will say at once, Don must have smelled woodchuck. But that is merely convenient answer, which does not explain or even consider the facts. Don already knew the general smell of woodchuck very well, and was, moreover, acquainted with the odor of the particular woodchuck to which his little dog chum had been laying siege. He knew it at first hand from the creature itself, Having once put his nose into the burrow, he got a secondary whiff of it in time. Nip returned from his fruitless digging, and he was utterly indifferent to such foolish hunting. Many times before the day of reckoning arrived, Nip had rushed into the yard in the same excitement, with the same reek of earth and woodchuck about him, and so as far as one may judge a dog by his action, Don took no interest in the little dog's story. Yet he was off on the instant of hearing that the familiar smell of woodchuck now meant something more than a hole in the ground. That some kind of message passed between the two dogs is, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt, and it is precisely this silent and mysterious kind of communication, the kind that occurs when your dog comes to you when you are reading, looks intently at your face, and tells you without words that he wants a drink, or that it is time for him to be put to bed, that I propose now to make clear. Before we enter that trail of silence, however, there is a much simpler language, such as is implied in the whistle of a quail, or the howl of a wolf, which we must try as best we can to interpret. For unless our ears are keen enough to distinguish between the food and hunting calls of an animal, or between Bob White's love note and the yodel that brings his scattered flock together, it will be idle for us to ask what message or impulse a mother wolf sends after a running cub when she lifts her head to look at him steadily, and he checks his rush to return to her side, as if she had made the murky woods echo to her assembly clamour. The simplest, almost obvious method of animal communication is by inarticulate cries, expressive of hunger, loneliness, anger, pleasure, and other primal needs or emotions. The wild creatures are mostly silent, and so is the bulk of their talk, but they frequently raise their voice in the morning or evening twilight, and by observing them attentively at such a time you may measure the effect of their so-called language. Thus you see plainly that to one call the animal cocks his ear and gives answer. At another call he becomes wildly excited. A third passes over him without visible result. A fourth sets his feet in motion toward the sound or else sends him flying away from it, according to its message or import. That animal cries have a meaning is, therefore, beyond serious doubt. But whether they have, like our simplest words, any definite or unchanging value is still a question, the probable answer being no, since a word is the symbol of a thought or an idea. But animals live in a world of emotion, and even our human emotions are mostly dumb or inarticulate. I must give this negative answer notwithstanding the fact that I have learned to call various birds and beasts, and that I can meet Hotspur's challenge on hearing Glendower boast that he can call spirits from the vasty deep. Yes, the birds and beasts will surely come if you know how to give the right call, but I am still doubtful whether among themselves their audible cries are ever quite so intelligible as is their silence. This question of animal speech has received a different and more positive answer, by the way, from a man who has spent many years in persistent observation of wild apes and monkeys. After watching the lively creature from his cage in the jungle, attracting them by means of various fruits and recording their jabber in a phonograph. He claims to have discovered the monkey words for food, water, danger, and other elementary matters. Moreover, when his phonograph repeats these simian words, the monkeys of another locality seem to understand them, since they run to the proper dish at the word food, or show evident signs of alarm at the word danger. It is doubtless much easier to deny such a conclusion than to prove or disprove it, but denial is commonly the first refuge of ignorance and the last of dogmatism, and with these we are not concerned. I do not know whether Garner claims too much or too little for his monkeys. I have never had an opportunity to test the matter in the jungle, and the caged monkeys with which I have occasionally experimented are too debased of habit or thought in their affections to interest one who has long dealt with clean wild brutes. At times, however, when I have watched a monkey with an organ grinder, I have noticed that the unhappy little beast displays a lively interest in the chitter of chimney swifts, a lingo which to my dull ears sounds remarkably like monkey talk. But that is a mere impression, momentary and of little value, while Garner speaks soberly after long and immensely patient observations. To return to first-hand evidence among wild creatures of my acquaintance, the crows come nearer than any others to something remotely akin to human speech. Several times I have known a tame crow to learn a few of our words, and what is much more significant, to show his superiority over parrots and other mere mimics by using one or more of the words intelligently. There was one crow, for example, that would repeat the word hungry in guttural fashion whenever he thought it was time for him to dine. He used this word very frequently when his dinner or supper hour drew nigh, giving me the impression, since he did not confuse it with two other words of his vocabulary, that he associated the word with the notion of food or of eating. And if this impression be true to fact, it indicates more than appears on the surface. We shall come to the wild crows and their talk presently. The point here is that if this bird could use a new human word in association with a primal need, there is nothing to prevent him from using a sound or symbol of his own in the same way. In other words, he must have some small faculty of language. Another tame crow, which an imaginative boy named Pharaoh Necho, because of his hippity-hop walk, proved himself inordinately fond of games, play, social gatherings of every kind. To excitement from any source, whether bird or brute or human, he was as responsive as a weather vane, but his play ran mostly to mischief, or to something that looked like joking, since he could never see a contemplative cat or a litter of sleepy little pigs without going out of his way to tweak a tail and stir up trouble. At times he would watch, keeping out of sight in a leafy tree or on the roof of the veranda, till Tabby the house cat came out and sat looking over the yard, her tail stretched out behind her. If she lay down to sleep or sat with tail curled snugly around her forepaws, she was never, ever attacked, But the moment her tail was out of her sight and mind, Necho saw the chance for which he had apparently been waiting. Gliding noiselessly down behind the unconscious cat, he would tiptoe up and hammer and the projecting tail with his beak. It was a startling blow, and at the loud squall or spitting jump that followed, he would fly off chuckling immoderately. When Necho saw or heard a gang of boys assembled, he would neglect even his dinner to join them, and presently, without ever having been taught, he announced himself master of a new art of yelling, "Yahoo! Come on!" which was the rallying cry of the clan in that neighborhood. He said this in ludicrous fashion, but unmistakably to those who knew him. Sometimes he would croak the word softly to himself, as if memorizing them or pleased at the sound, but for the most part he waited till boys were gathering for a swim or a ball game, when he would launch himself into flight and go skimming down the road, whooping out his new cry exultantly. What meaning he attached to the words, whether of boys or fun or mere excitement, I have no means of knowing. After learning this much of our speech, Necho took to the wild, following a call of the blood, I think, for it was springtime when he disappeared, and the crows' mating clamour sounded from every woodland. These birds are said to kill every member of their tribe who returns to them after living with men, and the saying may have some truth in it. I have noticed that many tame crows are like tame baboons, in that they seem mortally afraid of their wild kinsmen. But Necho was apparently an exception. If he had any trouble when first he returned to his flock, the matter was settled without our knowledge, and during the following autumn there was evidence that he was again in good standing. Long afterward, as I roamed the woods, I might hear his lusty "Yahoo! Come on!" from where he led a yelling rabble of crows to chivy or sleeping owl, or jeer at a running fox, and occasionally his guttural cry sounded over the treetops when I could not see him or know what mischief was afoot. He never returned to the house, and never again joined our play or allowed a boy to come near him. Of the tame crows I have chanced to observe, only a small portion showed any tendency to repeat words, and these gifted ones are, I judge, the same crows that in a wild state may occasionally be heard whistling like a yay, or barking or hooting, or making some other call which ordinary crows do not or cannot make. This last, which I have repeatedly observed among wild crows, is a very different matter of speech. But from the fact that these mimics learn to use a few English words more or less intelligently, one might not be far wrong in concluding that every crow has in his brain a small undeveloped nest of cells corresponding to our bump of language. A closer observation of the wild birds may confirm this possibility. Thus, when you hear a solitary crow in a treetop crying, "Haw, haw," monotonously, dipping his head or flirting his tail every time he repeats it, you may be sure that somewhere within range of his eye or voice, a flock of his own kind are on the ground feeding. That this particular haw is a communication to his fellows, telling them that the sentinel is on watch and all is well. Seems to me very probable. There are naturalists, I know, who ingeniously resolve the whole phenomenon into blind chance or accident, but that does not square very well with the intelligence of crow nature as I have observed it. If you are interested enough to approach any crow sentinel in a casual or indifferent kind of way, he will take alarm if you approach quickly or directly. You must note that his haw changes perceptibly while you are yet far off. It is no longer formal or monotonous, nor is it uttered with the same bodily attitude as your eyes plainly see. You would pronounce and spell the cry exactly as before. It should be written aw or haw, not caw, for there is no consonant sound in it. But if your ears are keen, they will detect an entirely different accent or inflection, as they detect different accents and meanings when a sailor's casual or vibrant sail ho sings down from the crow nest of a ship. Now run a few steps toward the sentinel, or pretend to hide and creep, and instantly the haw changes again. This time the accent is sharper, even to dull ears, and hardly is the cry uttered when all crows of the unseen flock whirl into sight, heading swiftly away to the woods and safety. Apparently, therefore, this simple haw of the crow is like a root word of certain ancient languages, the Chinese, for example, which has several different intonations to express different ideas, but which all sound alike to foreign ears, and which are spelled alike when they appear in foreign print. To judge by the crow's action, it is certain that their elementary haw has at least three distinct accents to express as many different meanings. One of all's well, another of watch out, and a third of be off. Moreover, the birds seem to understand these different meanings as clearly as we understand plain English. They feed quietly, while haw means one thing, or spring aloft when it means another. And though you watch them in a lifetime, you will see nothing to indicate that there is any doubt or confusion in their minds as to the sentinel's message. Not only the crows, but the wild ducks as well, and the deer and the fox and many other creatures, seem to understand crow talk perfectly, or at least a part of it which concerns their own welfare. Thus on the seacoast in winter, you hear the crows hawing continually as they follow the tide line in search of food. For hours this talk goes on, loudly or sleepily, and the wild ducks pay absolutely no attention to it. Many of the ducks, the black or dusky mallards especially, like to come ashore every day in a secluded spot under the lee of a bank, there to rest or preen or take a quiet nap in company. It is a tempting sight to see a score or a hundred of the splendid birds in a close group, their heads mostly tucked under their wings, but it is practically impossible to stalk them, for the reason that the crows are forever ranging the shore, and a crow never passes a group of sleeping ducks without lifting his flight to take a look over the bank behind them. What his motive is, no man can say. We only note that, in effect, he stands sentinel for the ducks against a common enemy, as he habitually does for his own kind. There is no escaping that keen, searching glance of his. He sees you creeping through the beach grass or hiding behind a bush. He flings out a single haul, with warning, danger, derision in it. And now the same ducks have heard him all day, without concern, spring aloft on the instant and head swiftly out to sea. And that concludes tonight's readings. I hope you have enjoyed listening to this story about animals and other beasts. If you're not quite tired yet, please feel free to listen to another episode of the Boy to Sleep podcast. I appreciate you listening to this episode, and I look forward to bringing you another episode very soon. Good night.